Mini episode 1779 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1779. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you. And very recently, we did Mini Episode 1776, which was our election preview show, coincidentally, there. And just as it was a long ways from 1776 to 1779 in the early days of the American Revolution, so too is it a long ways from Mini Episode 1776 to 1779, because now we know what happened in the election this year, with some minor, things going on here. Apparently, it's counting month out in California. So there's a few things we don't know yet, but there's most of the things we do know from the election. And this is our election recap show analysis. Where do we go from here? And the same outstanding panel that we had for that show, two folks who have been on the show for a long time separately. It's the first time we ever had them on a panel together. It was so great. We had to do it again. And again, you go back towards the very beginning of this show in the old Sports Talk Network days. Both of these guys have been on since then on political segments going back to the very, very early days of the first Obama term. Of course, we've been talking politics on this show with the proprietor of ePolitics, Colin Delaney. And he has been, of course, engaged in politics for a long time on the Democratic side, running his own website, providing analysis there, doing columns for campaigns and elections. And rarely has it ever taken, I would say, more for Colin to sort of come on a show than it has been for him to do it today. So we truly appreciate him doing it in this moment. It's probably been easier literally every other time he's come on, but I respect that. Colin, thank you for being here today and for lending your opinion about what happened and what's coming next.
I'm sorry, bartender. Could you give me another drink first?
Yeah. Well,
about how it feels, yeah.
Characteristically, Colin, at least you can laugh about it, right? I mean, that's, laughter is the best medicine, as they say. And the FDH Lounge has no shortage on it because, how's this for a segue, one of the funniest dignitaries that we've ever had in the FDH Lounge, our good-witted friend, our FDH Lounge dignitary from out there on out there in Queens, from the Queens Chronicle specifically, our good pal Lloyd Carroll, America's last Rockefeller Republican, and he is here to give his thoughts on this as well. So, Lloyd, not as dark of a day for you, perhaps, as it was for Colin, but neither did it go the way you wanted it to go either.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I didn't really have that much of too many dogs in this race, although I have to say, speaking of Queens, that Donald Trump is from the world's borough, so I guess we, better or worse, we have to acknowledge that. I don't know if he'll be building his library here, but nonetheless, and I think we learned something very important, Rick, last Tuesday. Texas still is not turning blue. We may have to wait a little longer.
Yeah, there's no Blexus on the near horizon. And I have to ask, Lloyd, you chart these things most assiduously here. Have you any kind of firsthand evidence that Donald Trump has been a reader of your Queens Chronicle columns over the years?
Well, actually, yes, but not as President Trump. I used to see him quite often. I write on a variety of topics and entertainment. And I remember the first time I met him was at the Friars Club. They were having a roast, and Trump was the guest of honor. And they actually held a press conference for him. And I remember Trump was doing his whole, I've seen grown men cry at this, blah, blah, blah. So the press is peppered with questions. So I raised my hand. I said, Donald, the fact that you grew up in Queens, does that give you a tougher skin? Is that an advantage for these kind of situations, put down roasts, et cetera? You have that tough Queens skin. He goes, being from Queens is always an advantage. So I sucked that line up, put it right in my column, sent it to Howard Rubenstein, his publicist. And, you know, Trump reads everything, so he was aware of the Queens Chronicle. And occasionally tapped me on the shoulder, go, what's new in Queens? So I've run to him a few times over the years. I always got a kick out of that. He is a proud son of the Worldsboro, so we have to give Donald Trump that.
Well, at the very least that, right? And I'm left wondering if past lounge guest, the late, great Pat Cooper, might have perhaps been one of the ones taking a run at him at that Friars roast. You never know. And we'll never get to ask Pat at this point, unfortunately. But as regards the election itself, I want to kind of start from, much as I had started us out last time with my sort of analysis of the, and I just went by the weaknesses of the various candidates because I thought that was what defined the race rather than the strengths. I'm going to start by putting out a central thesis that I have here for essentially more so, I guess, on the Democratic side. That's the side that's far more interesting to me because the Republican side, I mean, they're going to get in there. It's, you know, quite potentially going to be a circus again with some of these cabinet nominees. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. The far greater uncertainty is on the Democratic side. And that's where I want to start. And that's where I feel a little bit more certain as far as where I think things may be headed. And it's a thing. I'll start with you on this, Colin, to get your reaction first here. This is a thing, and I talked about this a little bit with Lloyd off air earlier today, but what kind of strikes me here is that I'm not going to make a comparison to 1980 as far as, oh, you know, the start of the Reagan years or anything like that. Not necessarily anything as far as where I think it's going to go on the Republican side, but on the Democratic side, I feel like where there's a commonality, 1980, it was maybe the third election in a row, maybe the fourth one, I think, where inflation factored in. But 76 and 80, it really seemed to factor in as an important issue. Inflation, the residuals of it this time anyways, the inflation over the course of the 4 years was big. But it's one of those things where I talked about this on the pre-election show and where I said that the swing of the country to the left over a period of time, I said I felt like Harris was fighting on terrain that wasn't as hospitable to her because you could see that the country was kind of, I think, turning from where it had been at that point. And you see now, and I'm sure you have some thoughts, Colin, on the thoughts afterwards here on intersectionality here and whether everyone should still be signing off on everyone's full length of demands and the whole Democratic coalition. But I get the sense the 60s, you know, we felt like there had been permanent changes in this country, and maybe they sort of bore out more so over the long haul. But it took until 1980 for there to be a real backlash to that. And if you think about it, I mean, Reagan was running ads at the time, you know, about welfare queens and stuff like that. So some of the ads that Trump was running this time on the trans stuff, I'd said to Lloyd off air, I initially thought that that was going to be a backfire because me, as a Midwestern social conservative who's basically turned nihilist, I just thought, you know, the younger generations, they've kind of turned this country into, you know, not what it was previously. I really thought that the country had changed, I think, more than it had. I think I overestimated that. I think the Democrats overestimated that. And I think, in a sense, the way that 1980 was a little bit of a reaction to everything that had been brewing since the 60s, everything I detailed on the election preview show dating back to, I'd say, Ferguson in 2014, Bernie Sanders in 2016, the real energy on the left, that the real energy in the Democratic Party, the Democratic coalition has been firmly on the left over the course of the last decade. And I think that this election will come to be seen as a reaction to that. And I think that's going to be the hardest thing for the Democrats to figure out going forward on that, because neither side, the more establishmentarian side nor the left, is going to give any ground and admit that they need to adjust going forward. How do you see it, Colin?
You raise some very good points first. I do want to caution about making, you know, grand pronouncements based on, you know, sort of where the parties stand and all of that. The Financial Times went back and found that this year was the first time since 1905 that basically every incumbent party in the industrialized democracies lost ground. I may have talked about, you know, the Brits and the French and all of that,
mm-hmm.
The last time we talked. But, you know, Macron lost his position. I mean, he's still president, but his party lost, you know, its position in the French parliament. The conservatives lost in Britain. The ruling party lost in Japan, just for some of the most recent. So it is possible that the biggest driver, just as you said, was the backlash against inflation. You know, to me, this was the another analysis I saw called it the second pandemic election. And this was when, you know, people had a chance to make it heard how they felt. But the other thing to be wary about is, now the numbers I was seeing last week suggested that Trump was likely to come a couple of million votes below his 2010 turnout,
mm-hmm.
or a 2020 turnout. Now, Kamala Harris is going to fall, you know, however many more below Joe Biden.
Sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And while there was very good turnout in a lot of conservative areas, particularly rural areas, the cities were down. You know, Democratic voters and suburban voters who might have leaned Democratic recently seem to have stayed home. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this. There are certainly men who would not vote for a woman, right? We know that that is true. And we know that that is particularly true of some black men who did not want to vote for a black woman, right? I think that, you know, inspired parts of our coalition and, you know, potentially turned off others. This is just a, you know, simple fact. And, you know, you talk about the, you know, sort of what you might call in the shorthand wokeness. The Democratic sort of campaign and activism apparatus does have a problem in that it is almost universally felt among the younger activists that, you know, defending trans people, defending gay people ought to be at the center of what we do, just almost uniformly. And any move away from that would have totally jeopardized their support and their volunteerism, you know? So how we thread that needle going forward is a tricky bit. But if you move past the presidency, you know, the Republican margin in the House is basically going to be within a rounding error of what it was before. The Republicans gained, you know, a handful of seats in the Senate in what was a, you know, very bad map year for Democrats. And you look further down the ballot, and while Democrats lost some ground in state houses, it was by no means a romp. And I just want to point out that after the June debate between Biden and Trump, there were internal Biden polls, apparently, that were showing a Mondale-level blowout, 1984-level blowout.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, the campaign and all of the activist groups deserve an enormous amount of credit for getting us to something that was relatively close to parity.
True, and this, I don't want to sit here and be a jerk, but I will say, I'm going to harken back pre-election here that you said I was missing all this pro-Harris enthusiasm out in the marketplace here. Okay.
So, I was wrong.
Okay. All right.
We were all missing it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, seriously, when I was talking to the head of the Michigan Democratic Party a week before, you know, 5 days before the election, 6 days before the election, they were confident they were hitting their numbers. I think one of the big discussions has to, you know, on the Democratic sort of apparatus, campaign apparatus side, is what the hell went wrong, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, again, parts of the coalition that weren't there. And, you know, as far as how it goes, Lloyd, that's a thing where I think maybe, you know, some of the internal contradictions might have been kind of coming home to roost here. And the whole thing of intersectionality, which AOC told us is the future, Lloyd, I got a feeling being there in New York that you're probably seeing things a different way right about now.
Well, hey, as much as I hate to disagree with South Bronx Barbie over there, she will never leave that seat. She's going to be looking like Nancy Pelosi by the time she leaves that seat. Her career is done, finis, at least as far as, you know. Somebody has to tell her that she's not in Dearborn. It's shocking news to her, San Francisco. New York State is not as true blue as a lot of people would believe, thanks to our great governor, Kathy Wokel, who could be the dumbest politician I've ever seen.
I'm not going to fight you on that one.
2 years ago, she campaigned again in New York. We have obviously a lot of problems with crime, still has cashless bail, light sentences. You know, they're still getting over the whole, what happened in 2020, George Floyd. But she was in a debate with Lee Zeldin, and, crime, big issue in New York. She's at the debate, and she says, when Zeldin pointed out about all the, how soft she was on crime, and Zeldin and Kathy Wokel looks at the camera and goes, "You just want to lock people up, don't you?" The Zeldin campaign couldn't have paid her to say that. I mean, enough money.
Right.
Then, okay, fine. You think everybody's made a mistake, rookie error. Now, the election was just last week, and she's running for re-election in 2026, at least I think she is. She wants to put congestion pricing back on. That was the killer for the Democrats before. She can't wait to put that for people who live out, for those who are out of the area who don't know congestion pricing. That means if you're not living in Manhattan, you could be living in New Jersey, Connecticut, anything in the tri-state area, if we include Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the quad state area, you're going to be hit with a $9 charge. I mean, if you live in Long Island, Westchester, you come into that's $9 per ride. That's not going to be forgotten about by 2026. I mean, I have to wonder if Jay Jacobs, who's the head of the New York State Democratic Party, I'm sure Colin, know of him. That's suicide. And it's the problem with the Democratic Party. They don't learn from mistakes. It's okay to make a mistake. Learn from it. And here's the other thing, which kind of got ignored, I think, in the media analysis. Trump did extremely well in New York City and the suburbs. I didn't win it, but certainly by far bigger margins than anybody had a right to expect. A lot of reasons for that. People have had it with the migrants. This is a reflection on the border issue. To me, the two smartest politicians in America right now could be Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, who sent all those migrants up to the blue states, and you know what? It made it sound, they made it sound like mean bullies at the time, but man, were they effective politicians? That was the smart play. Now taxpayers are getting, or even the most liberal taxpayers are upset that their funds are being spent to put up migrants in fancy hotels, debit cards, whatnot, plus you see them on scooters and mopeds, and not insured, they can knock people over. It's really gotten unlivable in that sense. And the other factor, of course, as you know, if you watched MSNBC, there are a lot of issues that can affect election. But if you watched MSNBC in prime time for the last 18 months, there's only one issue, Gaza. No other issue counts but Gaza. And they enjoy rubbing those liberal Jewish noses in the dirt every night on it just to make sure that it's almost like they were saying, well, we're the good guys on all the other issues, but sorry, Jews, you're going to have to accept your place on this because you have no choice. Well, no, they did have a choice. And I guess they were determined to make Jewish Democrats as loyal as Florida Republicans and Florida Cuban Republicans, not what I call smart politics. So those are some key reasons that kind of got buried.
The Jewish vote appears to have broken exactly like it did in 2020.
I don't believe it. I've seen the numbers. I don't believe it. Sorry.
All right. I mean,
nobody can know for sure, but just what happened in New York. Okay, let's even say nationally, maybe closer than you expected. But I can tell you, New York, it was about 40-some-odd percent. The numbers show up here.
So that's
going to have an effect in 2026 as well if that doesn't get corrected.
Well, so Colin, you could be right about it nationally, but there could still be, the whole thing's geographically.
Local variation.
So it's possible that you're both right to a degree. I'm going to ask another question, Colin, that's more so about the Democrats, because like I said, that is almost the more fascinating side of the equation for me from here at this point, because you don't a lot of times have elections in this country where it kind of comes out like where the losing side is like, where do we go from here? Usually that there's more of a path forward, it would seem like, than there is right now. And this is one of those things where I look at this thing, and again, everything that Trump did in appealing to Black and Latino voters was, let's be perfectly honest, half-assed at best. I mean, with the Black voters, hey, I got gold tennis shoes. I mean, are you kidding me? But, you know, it was still, hey, you know, and again, trying to, you know, hey, I've been convicted of stuff just like a bunch of you guys. Like, and somehow or another, that didn't come across as being racist, but endearing. But it's one of those things where this election proved, and something that I think is going to warm a lot of Republican hearts going forward for the medium to long term, and maybe should chill the Democrats medium to long term. We learned for the first time that demography is not destiny. When we get to that point here, mid-century or so, could be a little bit earlier, but when whites become a minority in this country, it's long been forecast, oh, that's the death of the Republican Party. Oh boy, are they screwed when the minorities are the majority. We cannot make that assumption anymore, Colin. The future is up for grabs in a way that we wouldn't have said maybe 10 days ago.
You might not have. When Rui Teixeira and his co-author came out with that book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, 20 years ago, I was skeptical.
Okay.
I don't think democracy, demography is destiny.
Okay.
I grew up in Texas where, as Latino, you know, as a small business guy moves up the ladder, you know, becoming Republican is a little bit like arriving, you know. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, right, when I was talking about, you know, one of the reasons that Texas is just so hard for Democrats to crack. And you'll note I did not predict an all-red win, right?
That's right.
The margin was worse than I had hoped, but what are you going to do? But no, I've never thought demography is destiny.
Okay.
I think that the Democrats do have a real problem with younger voters is guys, you know.
Right.
And there are a lot of reasons for that. Some of it, you know, potential backlash to Me Too and all that. A lot of young guys seem to feel like they don't have a place and they don't have a role model. And in a case like that, they're going to fall for a strong voice very often. You know, so that for the Democrats is, you know, a major issue. But I just say, you know, the folks that I've talked to, you know, there's not a whole lot of blame other than with Biden, to be totally honest. There's not a ton of blame game going on. You know, the notion that the centrality of woke, I think, is one of those that's sort of being taken as a given that the messaging has to change somewhat, right? I mean, you still are inclusive because otherwise, what kind of people are we? Too much, the Republicans won the messaging war on that front, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, you know, when you're talking about the elections, you know, I think 1980 with inflation is not a bad analogy.
Also the 60s backlash, too. I thought some of the residual 60s backlash reminded me a little bit of what we just saw.
It's certainly possible. It is possible. We don't know yet.
Right.
That's why I'm always reluctant about, you know, grand conclusions.
Sure.
You know, what it felt like to a lot of us was 2004, when you run what seems to be a credible candidate, you run what seems to be a good campaign, and you know, the early vote looks good, the day of vote looks good, up at the exit polls look good, up until like 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and then it goes off the rails. Now there, I think the biggest external factor was the war, right? That there were a lot of people who were reluctant to vote against Trump because they saw him as a president at war, where this time, it was the opposite dynamic, where Biden was the president at a time when people were unhappy with the way things were.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I've seen people draw a parallel to post-2004. And then, you know, again, you know, Bush dropping the ball in the second term on many fronts obviously opened the door for Democrats as well. But I want to pose the questioner to Lloyd to follow up on what you were saying there, Colin. Lloyd, you must have been chomping at the bit when you heard Colin talk about the Democratic softness with men, because I know that's one of your most cherished issues.
Yes. to put it mildly, absolutely. I think it started with Al Franken and then the whole Me Too movement, as Colin pointed out. But I do have some good news here for Colin and the Democrats. I don't think it's quite as bad, and coming from a Republican, it's almost shocking. That, you know, I think the field for the Democrats in 2028 is a lot stronger than what I saw running in 2020 against Trump. I mean,
I agree.
If you look at what they've got coming down the road, I mean, I saw Andy Beshear, who, if you're looking for the Bill Clinton of 2028, that is a Democrat who could, I say this in a positive way, not Bill Picknellos, yeah, but in a good way, good-looking guy, reminds me of John Edwards, and again, not looking for the Picknellos here, but the point is, a guy who can win in Republican areas, who, you know, he's got the looks, he speaks extremely well, that's one. You're looking also, Gavin Newsom will be chomping at the bit. Again, handsome guy, a guy who's a fighter. And I realize, the old California liberal. But, you know, the funny part is, I don't think people get as worked up on liberal conservative anymore as they once did.
Yeah.
And also, nobody can do what Donald Trump did. Donald Trump defies every law of gravity. I've jokingly called him the king of men. You know, all the rules get thrown out the window with Donald Trump. But he said, I can't run anymore. I mean, and I think there will be elections. I mean, I see Rachel Bitticoffer going, there'll be no more elections. I mean, I think people are getting a little dramatic here.
Right.
But there's going to be... Yeah, thank you. I mean,
that stuff's embarrassing.
No other Republican is going to be able to do what Donald Trump, including handsome Ronald DeSantis. He's one of the worst retail politicians I've ever seen. J.D. Vance, again, speaks very well, good-looking guy, but, again, doesn't seem comfortable with the masses the way Donald Trump does. That's going to be a big factor for Democrats going in, aside from, and we'll get to the clown show coming up in the cabinet, assuming this is even if things stay in the best case scenario for Trump and the Republicans. They're going to face more formidable competition in 2028. So I don't think things are quite that bad, but you're right. They do have to appeal to men. You know, it's funny. I was on your show. Remember we were talking about the Roe, and we joked that, you know, why couldn't some political action committee point out to the bros how a Roe repeal, remember we talked about this, Rick?
Right.
How a Roe repeal is going to work against college students. But it's hard enough to get lucky, guys, in college in your 20s. It's hard enough. Now with that Roe repeal, you're really looking at, good luck on that, guys. You'll be spending a lot of lonely nights. Nobody can come up with an ad like that?
There was a Democrat, a couple of guys formed a pack. They had jumped through a lot of hoops to figure out how to do all this. But they were running ads on some of the porn networks talking about Project 2025 and getting rid of pornography. So,
well, yeah.
That's how you appeal to, we're having a little fun with this, but that's how you appeal to those voters who could, the bros who were voting for Trump. And yet I blame the Democrats for that because whenever, you know, and I'm a Republican who looked at a Roe repeal as, wait a minute, you ever meet any single guy that says, I can't wait to pay child support for the next 18 years for unwanted kids? Or more government spending, more crime, you name it. And yet, that never came up because Democrats refuse, oh, it's a woman's issue, we can't do that, that would be offending our base. That's why they have a Demo Wimp Party. What a thing the game is to win.
I don't think anyone consciously made a decision not to target men about that.
I do think that's where I disagree, Colin. I think it was deliberate. Okay. Just keep it as women. Women, it's a women's issue. We agree. Women are the primary people on the battlefront lines. I get that. But there's a place that you could appeal to men on this issue where you could have gotten that bro vote and they just let it go.
I just don't know if I agree.
I mean, that's an outside-the-box way of looking at it, yeah. Lloyd. But, you know, as long as we're talking about the ads here...
I'm wrong. You may be out of the box, but I don't think I'm wrong.
Well, you know, not
well,
all...
We'll see what happens in 26.
Well,
they may try that.
By the time we're done, Lloyd, I'm going to top you with not necessarily a prediction on where we're going, but a scenario on where this country might be going. And it's nothing like what either of you two have heard before, I can promise you that. But before we get to that...
There's
the tease. Before we do that, as far as ads go and closing arguments and whatever, this is a thing, Colin, I'm looking at this like Harris deciding to close with Orange Man Bad. as opposed to talking about her. Did she have to pay royalties to Hillary Clinton for that one? Because after all, it worked so well in 2016. So the whole thing of, like, let's talk about him. Let's, again, if you don't think everything about him was baked in the cake long ago with everybody here, I just, that's one where, again, I do think overall, I mean, this might sound surprising coming from me, but I do think that for all intents and purposes, she managed the bad hand that she had more or less, at least middle of the spectrum. Maybe some could have done better. There's a lot that would have done worse. And she might have been above average in managing that bad hand. But the closing argument thing, Colin, I was shaking my head. And, of course, giving the answer on The View, I couldn't possibly think of anything I would have ever done different than Joe Biden. Here's the thing. It might sound too lawyerly, which, again, with her sometimes can be a thing. But all you got to say is, look, I'm vice president. I'm the most trusted advisor. My advice to the president is confidential. Have there been times where it didn't go my way? Of course, but I'm breaking that faith if I say anything publicly about this. He has to be able to talk to me. I'm still the vice president. He has to be able to talk to me today, tomorrow, next week, without it getting public what my advice was. So there were a couple of things there, I think, that were exceptions to the whole thing of, I think, managing the bad hand that she had pretty well.
Yeah, no, I think I think that she definitely bobbled that thing on The View. I think you're right that there were certainly things like that that could have been messaged a little bit better. The closing arguments, you were not the only one who was criticizing that. I think it was Priorities USA was raising flags like, hey guys, this is not what we are seeing in our focus grouping and polling, right? But at the same time, would it have mattered? I don't know.
Probably not. There is
a limit to what campaigns can actually do.
I agree.
And I think inflation probably, inflation and just the bad vibes from the pandemic, you know, probably. And Trump benefits from his over-the-topness in that, you know, I've seen quite a few, I've seen some numbers or, you know, several surveys where people just didn't really believe that he was going to do all the things he said he was going to do.
Right.
So now when he does them, what happens? I don't know. I mean, one problem the country has is that, you know, a good chunk of the country is not getting information from anything reliable, you know? So I worry that if he does, you know, do things that most people would reasonably object to, will they even hear about it?
Oh, they'll know about it. I mean, like, if Bobby Kennedy Jr. Ends up, you know, banning vaccines and stuff like that, we're going to know. So, I mean, I think, exactly. So, I mean, it depends on what it is and what happens, I think. But, you know, Lloyd, what are your thoughts on this? That I know you have some thoughts as well about, you know, again, there are limits to what Harris could have done with the bad hand that she had. But are you inclined to be, you know, quasi-generous in the way that I was and the Colin was?
Yeah, I'll be surprisingly generous. You pointed out The View. Look, you got to give the other team some credit here. So the ads they ran, I saw in the swing states, I saw in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that Harris is for they, them, and Donald Trump is for us. That was a very good ad.
I mean, that was good.
It worked.
That worked. The immigration, so yeah, there's nothing you could do. I mean, Harris was in a tough spot because of all these things. You know, I do want to, it's funny, I guess we're going to get to the cabinet soon enough, but I've got to ask you, Rick, Big Pharma, and Colin, you know this as well. I assume these big pharmaceutical companies that a lot of us have stock in, they're major contributors to the Republican Party. Am I missing something here that somehow I don't think they're going to take too kindly if Trump's HHS secretary is saying no more vaccines? I see a bit of a conflict there. And I'm a follow the money guy, so call me crazy on this, but I think if Bobby Kennedy did get in, you're not going to hear as much about his vaccine talk as I think a lot of people would be expecting.
Lloyd, I promise you, you've spent more time thinking about the ramifications of that than Trump ever did. So I guarantee you that's how you explain that one, because he just hasn't contemplated.
I may have a senator, but all those Republican senators and congressmen were up for re-election. They're going to be aware of it. Every lobbyist in D.C. is going to make them aware of it.
Right.
So I think Bobby Kennedy could have his little fun. But if it comes to, you know, really trying to change Big Pharma, good luck on that. I don't even think you'll be able to change Fruit Loops at this point in terms of its nutrition thing.
Well,
so, you know, Trump will let him go out, play. Is there any Trump's going to like this way? Yes. A guy who's crazier than him that could divert the attention. He's there as a clown. You know, I don't see him really doing anything except taking a little pressure off Trump in terms of the crazy things he'll do.
Well,
maybe that's the whole idea. Well, Trump's doing Project 25. The media sits and talks about Bobby Kennedy all day.
Well, you know.
You are not the first one to say that. Also that, you know, you nominate him or Matt Gaetz, knowing that there's a good chance they'll get knocked out, but whoever follows will be so much better in comparison that you get them through easily.
Well, Pete Hegseth also put Pete Hegseth in there, a guy who tried to get war criminals off the hook and lobbied Trump for that in his first term. So you got that going on. So, yeah, I mean, it's and the other thing is here, too. And look, it's easy to sit here. And it's almost like the kitten chasing the ball of yarn when you're looking at all of the, you know, different appointees and going, I can't believe that's happening. Although I will count myself out of the people bashing Tulsi Gabbard. I've been a longtime fan of hers, so it's fine if she wants to get in there. I have zero problem with that. I probably differ with you guys in that regard. But one of the things that I'm, because again, well, yeah. But the thing is, like, above all else, I think of myself, I mean, I analyze politics, but my true interest always is in on the policy end. And I'm looking at this here, and this is the thing where, again, I look at this, I'll start with you, Colin, that if we're just looking at this in more of a dry fashion here, as far as the substance of the cabinet, this is one of these things here where this is a very, and I'm not talking about Matt Gaetz or anything like that when I say a schizophrenic cabinet thus far, because you look at it, and it's like Miriam Adelson is getting her dream team here as far as Hegseth in there, Marco Rubio, so much for realism. But as I briefly alluded to on our pre-election show, Trump's realism gets a little schizo when it comes to the Middle East, because he's a blank check for Israel kind of guy. He's pretty hawkish towards Iran, so that gets in the way of his quote-unquote realism. So it's a thing where this cabinet is going to have some bare-knuckle brawls, because, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard is not going to be having it if the neocons are going to be on the war path and everything. So just like in terms of the makeup of the cabinet and the policy, you know, issues and questions that there may be. That's what's most surprising to me, Colin, is that he has folks in there that are just, it seems to me, exact opposites in a lot of ways in what they believe in certain areas.
Well, yeah, because they're puppets. Because he will be making all the real decisions.
Okay.
But yeah, that it wouldn't surprise me. You know, the more they're bickering amongst themselves, the less they can ally against him. Strong men know this. Stalin knew this. Hitler knew this. You know, you have people under you who, well, let's just go back to Sean Spicer. The day he had to lie about the size of the crowds.
Yeah.
Making them lie makes them demonstrate their loyalty, that they place loyalty over truth.
Okay.
And I think we're going to be seeing a whole lot of that.
Well, wait a minute, though, and I get what you're saying, but then also look at it a little bit deeper in the sense of Rubio, especially in his position, but they're going to be Rubio and some of the other ones in particular, certainly Hegseth, if God forbid he becomes Secretary of Defense, they're going to be in meetings with their counterparts worldwide. So they're going to be in there, and again, Trump's not going to be sitting in those meetings. So there's a certain amount of leeway that's built into the position that no matter how much you're a puppet of the main guy, you're in these private confidential meetings with other, you know, folks out there, your counterparts, heads of state, whatever. So they're going to have plenty of room to go out there and say what's on their mind specifically, not just the puppet master. So I think there's limitations to what you just said, Colin.
We shall see.
Yeah. We will. And Lloyd, I know you must be chuckling about this as well. And again, it's easy to look at the clownish nature of, again, Hegseth and Matt Gaetz and some of the ones in there and Bobby Kennedy Jr. How many bears is he going to dump in Central Park now that he thinks he's got a license for it? So it's easy to point and laugh at the clownish nature of some of the stuff. But on a policy level, this is where it gets intriguing and perhaps a bit disturbing in some areas.
Well, this is a classic Apprentice. Trump likes when, you know, I can see spitballs and, you know, cafeteria food fights at these cabinet meetings. This will be great.
Yeah. Well,
you know, that's classic Trump. He loves this stuff.
Well, I mean, look, for somebody that got back in there and actually had, you know, unlikely swaths of the media admitting that he's got at least to some degree a mandate, for him to be self-destructive enough to piss that away for his own amusement would certainly be par for the course. And I say that again, as somebody that's been a convert to nihilism in recent years and actually had a policy area, maybe thought that I might have some room to be surprised on the optimistic side. Yeah, once these appointments started coming out, it was like, yeah, well, maybe I was right to be a nihilist in the first place, because maybe this is where it's heading. But this is one of these things, as we take a little bit longer view of this and what it might augur for the next presidential election. I know it was mentioned earlier by Lloyd, Andy Beshear, and some of the other candidates out there as well. But I'm going to start with you, Colin, because this is really your bailiwick, is knowing what's going on the Democratic side and analyzing trends and trying to gauge where it's going. This is one of these things where, again, even if Trump is a complete dumpster fire in the second term, it's going to be one of these things where, yeah, it might make it a little bit easier to win the next election. But, I mean, as we've seen with Biden, winning is one thing. Governing in a way that keeps the entire coalition together is another thing. And maybe I'm prisoner of the moment, but I look at Andy Beshear and I look at anybody else, and it's like they're going to be doing the splits like a mofo, trying to keep one leg in each of the camps here, trying to keep them happy on things, because you're seeing, I mean, I really didn't think we'd ever see the day. We're seeing, you know, Bernie Sanders taking shots at Nancy Pelosi. Like, it's all out there right now. And it's one of those things where the establishment and the left are both pushing back on each other and trying to assert their own primacy. So it's like, if Trump's a big enough disaster, the Democrats could win the next election, but it's going to be another one-term deal if they don't settle this. And I honestly, maybe you have a better idea, Colin, because you're on the inside and you see these things happen, but from the outside, I have no way of seeing and knowing who's going to win. And ultimately, as is always the case, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. We saw it for a long time in the Republican Party where there was a pushback against Trump, but over the course of the last decade, he has consolidated it. That's why you saw out there Liz Cheney out there with the Democrats, because she had nowhere to go. Something tells me that you're going to see leading Democrats that are going to become independents at some point or whatever it would be. I don't see them necessarily aligning with the Republicans, but I couldn't possibly tell you which faction it's going to be. What's your sense of how the two factions are going to play out in the years to come, Colin?
Well, there aren't two factions. There are dozens of different interests.
Okay.
That align with each other sometimes and oppose each other at other times, right? I mean, I worked in the state legislature. That was very much the way it was. Democrats having Republican allies on one fight and fighting against those same Republicans on a different fight. And I think you're going to see a lot of, that sort of jockeying. But if you're going to use Bernie Sanders as an example, remember that he has been taking pot shots at the Democratic establishment since the late 70s.
Vaguely,
right?
Though. More vaguely. He doesn't personalize it generally.
Go back and look at what Bernie is. I mean, he only became a Democrat like a week,
Right, right. But aside from when he was a presidential candidate and you have to run against people, he's always kept it more like in terms of running against the blob, so to speak. Calling out Pelosi is a different step than I've ever seen from this guy.
Well, I don't know. I think it is very easy to draw, like I've said, broad conclusions from a handful of loud voices.
Okay.
When I talk to Democratic activists, we're not divided. Like, the overwhelming mood the day after the election was sadness, but determination.
Okay.
It's like, you know, I've been here before. I was just talking to my dad the next day. I'm like, well, I've been here before. You know, we know what to do, right? Everybody just needs to take a few weeks and get some sleep. But there are obviously, divisions within the party. There are people who have different priorities. I honestly don't see that as much of an issue. I think Democrats are going to be united just like they were largely united, Gaza was the one exception, largely united behind Harris, I think we're going to see something similar in the midterms and then in 28.
Well,
and I think a lot of people, looking at the midterms, I think a lot of people who either voted for Trump or who stayed home are going to have a ton of buyer's remorse.
That's very possible. I mean, the midterms are generally just a referendum on the incumbent, and it's almost always a thing of like, oh, he hasn't fixed all the problems yet. Screw that guy. I mean, there are exceptions to it, 1998, 2002, 2022. But generally speaking, the incumbent takes it in the shorts. Trump should expect nothing different. And that's why, again, I was led to believe after they won that they were going to be trying to storm out of the gate for the first 2 years. Some of these appointments to the cabinet might suggest otherwise. But Lloyd, what's your sense of how much unity there might or might not be on the Democratic side in the years to come, regardless of what Trump does?
Well, excuse me, Rick. I tend to think, kind of like Collins, I think when you're out of power and you want to win, particularly someone who's a lightning rod like Trump, I think the factions will not be as big a story as you might think. I mean, you're always going to hear some lefty stuff, but here's the thing. If somebody could just name me one election where a leftist beat a center-right, not talking in a competitive race, so not talking about, you know, San Francisco or New York City, you know, that's never happened as far as I can tell. I mean, I still remember George McGovern. I mean, hey, come on, it's Democrats, I don't think they've ever gotten over 72 in a lot of ways. Even when Walter Mondale got beat as badly as he did, then we could say, well, Walter was a leftist, that's why he got beat. Ronald Reagan was just extremely popular. It didn't make a difference who the Democrats put up then. So it's no fault that he was just the wrong place. And let's face it, Walter was not exactly a scintillating personality.
Well, look, being Carter's vice president doomed him, though. I mean, he had thumped Carter.
I don't think anybody said, I can't wait to go to that Walter Mondale rally, and God bless me, rest in peace, but that's just, that's my take on it. I think the Democrats have a pretty good field here. I mean, the only one who probably is most upset about what happened last week is Gretchen Whitmer, because I wouldn't be forming any exploratory committees if I were her. I'd say she's going to be everybody's VP list, but, I mean, I wouldn't even think about running. I mean, there's no point in putting yourself out like that. You know, what's the definition of insanity? When you do the same thing over and over again, expect a different result. So I don't think that's going to happen. I did say on the last show, I always felt that the first female president would be a Republican, because I thought it was a Nixon-China thing, and I guess that part so far has a shot of being proven true. But I got to worry about my side here. You know, Trump is a lame duck after, you know, he can't run in 2028. I'm not so sure J.D. Vance is going to be handed everything. This could be an interesting race to see who jumps in on the Republican side.
But yeah, I wouldn't think that J.D. would be anyone's, first pick, right? He'll have the Trump mantle, one assumes. But hell, we don't know what Trump's going to be like in 4 years. The man may be drooling in his soup, right?
He is 70. He's going to be 79 in July. You know, it's funny. We're going to give Joe Biden this, and seeing some things that Trump has said. I mean, it could very well devolve into that. We don't know.
Well, it could. Yeah,
nobody gets sharper with the passage of time.
Who do you think are the potential up-and-comers, not Trump sycophants, right, but you know, people who have a realistic chance to be a normal Republican again?
You know, it's funny. Again, look, I mean, DeSantis obviously has to run because he's running DeSantis in Florida. He's going to get pushed. Tom Cotton is a guy who's an interesting guy because he went to all the Ivy League schools. He speaks in a very reserved manner. He doesn't come off as the raving lunatic on the Sunday talk shows.
He is a neocon.
Larry Hogan didn't win his race in Maryland, if no other reason, that it would have been nice to have, you know, that old school Rockefeller Republican. At least I have somebody I can point to. I don't think William Weld is going to be running in 2020.
Yeah.
I supported him in 2020. I never got a chance to vote for him in a Republican primary. There's no John Kasich for me. Sorry, Rick. I know that's a sore spot for you, but
I don't like Kasich, so that's fine.
I don't think there's any Republican in Ohio ever says I like Kasich. But
no.
be that as it may, there's no. It's gonna be very slim. slim pickings for me. Let's just say I don't think the Ripon Society is going to be hosting any presidential debates.
Well, the other thing is, and I just, you guys may be overthinking this a bit in the sense of, does anybody think Trump's just going to sit there and idly let it happen without making it about him? Everything's always going to be about him. Chances are it's an endorsement of Vance, and that's that. Because basically that makes...
That could be, but we don't know how the rank and file... We don't know what's going to happen in 4 years, and he's going to be the same Donald Trump at that point. He may be... I know it's hard to picture this, but, you know, by 4 years from now, he might be a lame duck, and people say, we need a change. We need to have a... You know, we need to move the party in the next direction. It's... One never knows. But particularly with the presidential stakes like that, the one thing I always remember with Trump, he could say anything, his supporters do anything. You know what the one area he couldn't do? Talk about the vaccine. You know, his greatest accomplishment, Project Operation Warp Speed, which even the biggest liberals will say, you know what? That was a good thing.
Yeah.
We're not even allowed to be brought up.
Right.
When he talked about getting other vaccines, the follow-ups, and Bill O'Reilly, I think, asked him if he got the, you know, the booster, and he said, yeah, and the crowd started booming. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, this really got me. I think that kind of freaked him out. And to me, that's extremely dangerous.
It is.
You know, they kind of know nothing stuff. And I used to say, Rick, when I was the reason I became a Republican was I believed that we were the elitists, we were the snobs. I took pride in that. With William F. Buckley. I mean, it's not Jesse Waters. I mean, I took pride in that.
Well, you know, that's one of those.
The party of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that. I will say this though. I mean, and I've as much as I've. You know, harshed on Trump with some of the other things that I've said here in this. I'll kind of bring it all the way around here by just saying that what Trump did, and again, a number of things here, and again, for as much as I say, you know, on all these things, oh, he'd be, you know, further along if he hadn't done this, if he hadn't done that, because he is his own worst enemy on a lot of stuff. But in the broad sense, what his backers get right is the number of things that only he could have done. And it's one of those things where I struggle to think of a conventional Republican politician that could have. They've completely flipped the party since the flop of the Bush years. The neocon stuff, all of that kind of stuff. They basically, what's hilarious to me is people that were the biggest Bush boosters in the world that have turned into the biggest Trump boosters. Who, when Obama was office, they were sneering like, oh yeah, blame Bush. And like, you never hear them talking about that now that Trump came in and erased the party of Bushism. But for anybody that could have given the party an image rehab from the George W. Bush years, I mean, he did it. I struggle to think of a conventional politician that could have done that and could have done that so thoroughly. But, you know, that's sort of my wrap-up thought here, you know, coming out of this election and going forward. I'll throw it to you for yours, Colin. What's any thoughts that you have that we didn't get to yet?
I tremble for the future of the Republic, and I'll leave it at that.
I saw that one coming. I think we all saw that one coming. Lloyd, what's yours going to be? Probably not quite as downcast, I'm guessing.
No, to quote that great 1953 song, that's entertainment. I think we're going to have the most entertaining presidents. We didn't say it'd be good, but I guarantee that it's going to be entertaining. This is why all the media was kind of, even MSNBC was secretly rooting for Trump, the king of ratings and subscriptions. I bet Rachel Maddow will be reading at least four pages of Project 2025 for the next 4 years and her useless oligarch stories. I can't wait to hear them.
Yeah. Well, you know, all the resistance wine moms will be springing up around you any day now. So we have that to look forward to again. And I have a number of friends that are resistance wine moms, even if they're not the right gender or, frankly, age. They're resistance wine moms. I have male and female friends in their 20s that might as well be resistance wine moms. So they're going to be on the...
Oh, Lord. Well, you know, we should get them T-shirts. Trump is a meanie with an exclamation point.
Yeah.
That's some winning messaging.
Lloyd, they will wear them unironically if I get them for them. I promise you that.
That's the funny part. Hey, that's going to be MSNBC's programming for the next 4 years.
Basically, yeah. But hey, as long as there's shows like this here to make you laugh while we're doing the analysis, that's what we're here for. So along those lines, Colin, I want to say thank you so much for being here. I hope that laughter was the best medicine for you, my friend.
It was a joy, as always.
Well, thank you so much. The great Colin Delaney from ePolitics.com and Lloyd Carroll, FDH Lounge dignitary and a longtime Queens Chronicle columnist. Lloyd, thank you for being here as well, my man.
Well, I got to tell you, Rick, it's always a lot of fun. And Colin, I really enjoy being with you here. I guess we should book 2026 sometime before that to do our pre-midterms and post-midterms mortems. I'm looking forward to that.
You know what? This is such a great panel.
See.
Let's not wait that long. This is such a great panel.
Yeah.
There's going to be all kinds of political developments happening. I'm going to hope that the next time that we go to break stuff down, it'll be with you two guys. I really, really, really appreciate it. Thank you both so much. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1779.